Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. Today we're going to talk about the history of Bitcoin. It really is a mysterious background of how all this stuff started. There's this anonymous character from Japan. I always chop his name, so forgive me if I say it wrong, Satoshi Yokomoto. And he supposedly came up with Bitcoin, the world's first cryptocurrency. Of course, it is based on the technology called blockchain, which anybody who follows my show knows that Kels Wilson technically came up with it first. You know, they don't even know each other. It happened in the past with other technologies where two people and two different parts of the world comes up with the same technology. Kels Wilson just came up with it first, and his was based on document, trying to eliminate document fraud in the legal world. Totally different usage. He wasn't thinking about it from a cryptocurrency standpoint, but this anonymous person was thinking about it, which is a whole nother paradigm, replacing money. Big deal. As you know, the control of currencies has caused wars, endless wars through all of history over who controls money. It, you know, the petrodollar is a lot of why we have problems in the Middle East. It's a big deal who controls currency. So the history of cryptocurrency starting with Bitcoin is a big deal. Why did it start? Who started it? Was it really created organically? Or is there some government behind it, even if it appears organic? I don't know. And I don't know if we're going to get the answers to that. But I do have Brian Iha coming onto the show, who has done the most comprehensive research to date on this subject. His book, anyways, is the most comprehensive with the most research put into it. And he answers many of these mysterious questions. There's still, of course, going to be some left on the table. And I'm not sure if within this alt media world, if any of us will be happy at the end as far as all these answers being given, because we're going to be seeking even more. But it is the most comprehensive history to date, and he does have answers that many don't know. So I'm bringing him onto the program to discuss the history of Bitcoin. So let's get into that interview now with Brian Iha.
Hi, Brian. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me.
Well, you have done a ton of research into figuring out what Bitcoin, how it started, and all the stuff behind it. But let's talk about something first. An anonymous person by the name of Satoshi Nakamoto, you're going to have to pronounce it right for me. I always pronounce it wrong. Originally came up with the concept of Bitcoin with blockchain, although I've interviewed somebody who I believe was the first one to come up with blockchain, which was Kels Wilson. I have all that information. But he was the first one to do blockchain with Bitcoin, which was completely revolutionary in the fact of doing cryptocurrencies. Who is this guy?
Well, this is one of the kind of founding myths of Bitcoin in a way. And everything you said is accurate. So it's not a myth in that sense. But I guess a legend would be the better term, because Satoshi Nakamoto is not the real name of the person who invented Bitcoin. It's a pseudonym. And in fact, to this day, people don't know for sure who he really was. In fact, some people have even theorized that it could have been a small group of brilliant people all working together, but, you know, representing themselves as kind of a singular figure. And that it has been a theory some people have had, but I've talked to people, I've heard from some people who they understand code better than I do, and they say, having looked at the first version of the Bitcoin software that Satoshi Nakamoto released into the world in January 2009, they say it's written in an idiosyncratic way, in the same way that a master painter everyone has an individual brush stroke. And if you're like an art expert, you can actually determine the real thing from a forgery by closely examining the brush strokes in the paint. They say it's kind of like a brush stroke in the code, that it seems to be the work of one idiosyncratic mind rather than something that was kind of put together by committee. So, that's pretty interesting because, as you mentioned, this is it's a radical paradigm shift. It is revolutionary. And for one person to have come up with this very non-obvious idea or non-obvious solution to this idea of creating digital cash, he would have had to understand a lot about cryptography, a lot about, computer engineering, a lot about economics, and just all these different fields that we don't usually think of as something that one person can kind of master all of that. And so, yeah, it's pretty fascinating.
Although there could have been multiple people designing it with one programmer.
I suppose that's possible. You know, there could have been there could have been something like that. Yeah.
Well, renegades are thought of as the players behind Bitcoin. But some companies, such as Overstock, accepted Bitcoin and others. And then even Target was talking about accepting it. I guess they didn't. I don't know if they do now, but it took a while for them. But it seemed kind of odd that corporations were wanting to jump on the bandwagon pretty quickly. People start to wonder, was there something bigger behind Bitcoin versus just an anonymous renegade? What do you say about that?
Well, no, I discovered it was really a true grassroots kind of movement. You know, the corporations like Overstock didn't start accepting Bitcoin really until the early days of 2014. I think it was January 2014 that Overstock announced it would be accepting Bitcoin. That's 5 whole years after Bitcoin was created. Bitcoin's been around for less than 10 years. So that was, sort of more than half of its lifespan so far, before these corporations really started taking notice of it. And Overstock, its CEO happens, this guy named Patrick Byrne, he happens to be kind of radical, sort of, libertarian figure himself. So he jumped on the bandwagon earlier than some people because of his own convictions that lined up with the convictions of these early renegades that advanced Bitcoin. But yeah, to answer your question, it was really a lot of kind of free market libertarians and crypto anarchists who saw the potential of Bitcoin early on. You know, these are people that they kind of want to use network culture to increase personal liberty as they see it and undermine the state and sort of operate economically and in other ways, outside of government control. And because of those philosophical convictions, they were among the first to really see the interest and possible, value of Bitcoin. And, when Bitcoin was so small in its infancy and was, today it's one Bitcoin is worth over about $3,400, but, in the early days it was hardly worth anything. It certainly didn't look like a good competitor to credit cards or, bank accounts and so on for most people in America. So it really took these unusual, somewhat fringe types to see its value.
Well, Overstock, that's kind of interesting because I remember reading about the Overstock company and how he had some major problems with Wall Street and mm-hmm. he almost got taken down. So it really gets people like that thinking differently and wanting to, they end up creating enemies by taking people down. All right. So it's interesting that Overstock got involved with that, but you spent an enormous amount of time doing research into the history of Bitcoin. What methods did you go about to figure it out, and how did you learn all this stuff? Because, there are a lot of people that think that there's big players behind this, that ultimately governments want to control and have digital currencies. And so people are questioning, was it really a renegade type of group? Or was it a big, big establishment players acting like it's a renegade type? So, what did you do to learn this? And because you really believe that what you came up with is what it is.
Well, I mean, sure. I talked to, among the sources in my book was a guy named Gavin Andreessen, for instance, who, when Satoshi Nakamoto, after a few years, stepped away from Bitcoin, which I think was actually one of the brilliant things he did, to avoid it just becoming a cult of personality, and he was able to allow it to stand on its own. He kind of handed the reins over to this guy, Gavin Andreessen, to be the new lead developer of the Bitcoin software. And Gavin had been helping Satoshi for quite a while as sort of his right-hand man. But then he was kind of the lead Bitcoin developer after that. But guys like Gavin Andreessen and so on, who were there from the very early days, you know, they can tell you that it was a very small community. One of the things I did was go back and look at the early forum posts. There's this one still today. There's this one main Bitcoin forum discussion board online where people post about it. And now there, of course, there are like Reddit threads for it and so on. But in the early days, there was this one forum, and you could actually read all of the posts on the forum because the community was so small. You could actually read all the new stuff that had been posted every day, and you could go back through the archives and read the whole archives. The first time I ever wrote about Bitcoin as a professional journalist was in the summer of 2012. But yeah, to back up even further to January 2009, or even earlier than that, Satoshi first announced his invention to the world in August 2008. He published a white paper on a mailing list for cryptographers. Very, you know, small, very kind of wonky, niche type of group. And in fact, many of the initial reactions to his white paper were negative. People were trying to point out flaws or saying, well, this won't work because of this reason or that reason. And he very patiently explained, no, this is, I anticipated that problem, and this is what I've designed in order to, you know, prevent that from being a problem or to solve that problem. And, but ultimately when people were asking him to, you know, they were kind of, you know, demanding more and more sort of evidence or theory for why his invention would work, he said, listen, I've already written the code. He said, I actually went ahead and wrote the code first before writing the white paper because I wanted to prove to myself that it would work. You know, rather, he had seen earlier attempts to create digital cash sort of go nowhere or flop. And he thought, no, I'm not going to just theorize about it. I'm going to invent the system first, and then I'll write a white paper to explain what I've done. And so he said, at this point, it would be easier to just release the first version of the software and let you see that it works for yourselves. And so that's what he did a few months later. And but yeah, I mean, I went back, and there were a number of other reporting techniques I used and a number of other sources who became like the main characters in my book. I never interviewed Satoshi personally, but I've been able to go back on these different mailing lists and forums and so on where he posted, and also speak to some of the early guys that interacted with him. And yeah, no, it's pretty clear to me how the space evolved.
So why do you think he wanted to be anonymous?
Oh, well, I think it's obvious in a way. I think that, you know, anyone who's going to invent this thing that could be potentially considered a rival to, you know, national government currencies, he could be a big target. I mean, first of all, he could be a target by governments who could shut him down. There were these earlier attempts to create forms of electronic money that I cover in the first chapter of my book. One was called eGold, and the guys running that operation got shut down, you know, indicted for money laundering, all kinds of stuff because of things their clients were doing. And I think Satoshi wanted to instead, you know, to not, you know, be targetable or liable for that. And another thing, of course, Satoshi was the one who was the first one to mine Bitcoins. He ended up with quite a large store of them. If you look at the value of Bitcoin today, you know, I think he'd be a billionaire. It looks like he has not really touched any of his Bitcoins. You can actually go look on the ledger, which is called the blockchain, that records all of the Bitcoin transactions going back to the beginning of time in January 2009. And it looks like, you know, the blocks that people think they've identified as being the ones that Satoshi mined, these blocks of coins, it looks like he hasn't moved any of them. But regardless, you know, if he's still alive, and some people think maybe he's not, but if he's still alive, you know, he has vast wealth in the form of this digital currency. And can you imagine, you know, the people who would target him for kidnapping or extortion or things like that? So I think it makes a lot of sense. You know, one of the things I knew as a technology journalist before doing this book was that early internet pioneers had always anticipated that a payments protocol would be woven into the fabric of the World Wide Web. And actually, Peter Thiel, one of the co-founders of PayPal with Elon Musk, when they were building PayPal in the late 90s, their original ambition was to create an internet currency that would replace the US dollar for online transactions. And that sounds kind of like Bitcoin in a way, but they had to pivot away from that, not because of the dot-com bubble bursting, but actually because of the new financial regulations that came down in the wake of 9/11. They were afraid of being accused of money laundering and so on. So that, I think, is one of the brilliant things Satoshi did. Rather than just start a new company like PayPal and try to get venture funding and grow it, he instead designed this network that no one would own, but anyone could participate in, and it wouldn't have a CEO or some central figure who could be targeted for indictment.
Well, it's a very serious thing if you're going to be competing with the US dollar, with the petrodollar. I mean, we've been in major wars because of the petrodollar. So I also think it's a great thing if he's still alive that he becomes very wealthy, because I think somebody who creates something deserves, you know, they deserve to be rewarded for something they've done.
Well, it certainly wasn't the idea of, hey, let's have digital cash is kind of easy to think of, right? Like you see in Star Trek, there's, you know, or Star Wars, there's people, they talk about credits, and it's like they clearly have some kind of, you know, cashless society that they're living in. But the way in which he went about it, the way to you know, reconcile all of the factors you need to in order to make it possible, that was very non-obvious. So yeah, I agree with you that, you know, someone like that should see a benefit if he's able to, you know, succeed in his invention.
Well, since the dollar is so highly automated, I mean, finance companies, government, the whole thing is, so much of it is digital anyways. Do you really see that much of a big step to go to cryptocurrencies?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that, you know, most financial institutions, although they're fascinated with blockchain technology, and they're all, which is the technology underlying Bitcoin, and they're all, you know, trying to create their own versions of it or adopt versions of it, because they like the way that it can cut out the middlemen in these different transactions, and it allows for the recording and verification of transactions without any central authority. So they think it can save them a lot of back office costs and help them do cheaper, faster payments and so on. Some of the big banks like Mitsubishi UFJ Financial Group, which is in Japan and it's the world's third largest bank, they are partnering with an American Bitcoin company called Coinbase. They're sort of the closest thing there is to a blue chip company in the Bitcoin world right now. Well, MUFG is partnered with Coinbase to try to use Bitcoin for cross-border payments. You know, right now this is one of the big pain points in international banking. It can take days for money to move, you know, from one country to another. There are transfer fees and money exchange, currency exchange fees involved. And often the process is sort of opaque. The person sending the money or the institution sending the money doesn't even know in advance how much they can expect to pay in terms of the fees until the money actually arrives. So there are some companies experimenting with Bitcoin or other digital currencies for cross-border payments. In terms of, you know, governments using them as like a unit of account or the main form of money, I think that's pretty far off. But I will say Japan just this past spring declared Bitcoin to be legal tender. It was the first country in the world to do so. So basically, you know, the Bitcoin is legal in the United States, but the government hasn't gone so far as to say, yes, this is legal tender that we view as a valid form of money on par with the US dollar or something. Well, that's basically what Japan did. And it gave people a lot of sense of security that this is a real thing that they can feel confident holding and using and spending, because they know now the government's not going to try to ban it or do anything bad like that. Well, Japan's the world's third largest economy, and I think that made a lot of people sit up and take notice.
Well, hasn't the UN backed Ethereum? Like, aren't they doing major projects with it?
The UN, it's not proper to say they've backed Ethereum, but I did hear something about They might be trying to use technology related to Ethereum to do some kind of a digital identity project in Africa or the Middle East, but I don't know a lot about that particular initiative.
Yeah, there was some news out a couple weeks ago about how they're gonna really take a deep dive into Ethereum for some of their projects, which I thought was really interesting because that, like Japan backing Bitcoin, if they seriously use Ethereum, that's a big deal.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the news from Japan back in April helped contribute to this huge spike in the price of Bitcoin that we've seen over the last several months. I mean, today Bitcoin's market cap, the value of all the digital currency in existence, it's over $55 billion, and it started the year, below $20 billion. So it has increased hugely in a short amount of time.
Well, who do you think is actually more concerned with the Bitcoin or with cryptocurrencies implementation? And what do you think they're really concerned about?
I mean, I certainly think it's something that, law enforcement is closely monitoring. Particularly, you might know about this outbreak of what they call ransomware attacks. This is where, cyber criminals are able to get a particular kind of malicious software onto your computer. And basically, what it does is it locks up a lot of your data. So it might, if you're just an individual, it might encrypt your precious family photos or tax documents or anything else that's important on your computer. If you're a company, it might encrypt, important spreadsheets or other documents. And then essentially, it demands ransom in the form of bitcoins, usually $300 or $400, something like that. It demands this ransom in exchange for the key that can unlock your data. And because your data is locked up with a very sophisticated cryptography, essentially you're out of luck if you don't get that key from the cyber criminals. And so this is actually something that is reaping millions and millions of dollars for cyber criminals around the world now. And it is something that has become possible in a sense through the existence of digital currency, because it's Bitcoin is a form of peer-to-peer digital cash. I can send money to you from the other side of the world in minutes without having to go through any bank or payments company like PayPal. So it's certainly it allows cyber criminals in a sense to kind of reach out from the other side of the world and maybe extort money from you. So that is something, law enforcement has been trying to crack down on that, has been trying to go after the people behind it, but it's kind of like anything else in a way. Criminal activity mostly thrives on cash, right? Because cash is even more anonymous than Bitcoin. Once I take cash out of the ATM, I could give it to somebody for drugs or anything else, and nobody knows where that cash went. And there's this huge demand for like US $100 bills around the world. Most US $100 bills don't even exist in the United States. They're overseas being used for other purposes. And some of those purposes are certainly illicit. So I think the government is trying to focus, not cracking down on cryptocurrencies, but cracking down on the crime that people are doing where they happen to be getting paid in cryptocurrencies, or they happen to be using cryptocurrency in some way.
Well, crimes are becoming pretty complicated, don't you think? I mean, with all this stuff going on, it's really becomes the people who have to try to take them down have to be experts themselves.
Oh, I mean, it's tough. Like, let's say there's some cyber criminal in Ukraine who attacks an American, corporation, and actually there have been some instances of, like, for instance, a hospital in California was hit with ransomware, and they ended up having to pay $17,000 or maybe more in ransom because it infected multiple computers in the hospital. So even if I think only every computer only had to pay a few hundred dollars, it was the whole network kind of got taken down by this, and they had to pay a really large ransom to get it back up. Well, if you're the FBI or whoever, how do you go after somebody who's in Ukraine? Ultimately, you have to coordinate with law enforcement agencies abroad, and it becomes this multi-pronged, multi-agency effort. And certainly, I imagine that can be really difficult. But in terms of just the sheer, I guess the technical aspects of it, like you're saying, yes, law enforcement has had to develop kind of methods of data analysis, I believe, that allow them to kind of track the flow of money in these new digital currencies, because law enforcement had gotten pretty good at tracking, you know, the flow of illicit money through the banking system and the traditional finance system. I mean, we shouldn't think, by the way, that the traditional finance system has its hands clean in any of this, and it's just digital currencies that we need to worry about. I mean, we know a few years ago, HSBC was fined billions of dollars in the U.S. because they were found to have been laundering money for Mexican drug cartels and stuff like that. And then just last Thursday, I think, or last week, you might have heard, in Australia, the Australian government accused the country's biggest mortgage lender, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, of just these huge breaches of money laundering and counterterrorism or terrorism financing rules. So,
I've covered this stuff a lot in my shows. And just recently, I just a couple days ago heard, and I'm actually really glad about this, hundreds of charities in Europe, I think it was actually England that did this, are being taken down because they're being used for money laundering. People are using charities in nefarious ways, which we all know, but it's in bulk.
Yeah, that happens with Islamic terrorism. Certainly there are these organizations that sort of front as, you know, religious organizations or Islamic charities. And it turns out that not all of them, of course, but in some cases, it turns out that they have a more nefarious purpose. And so, yeah, you know, it's something that the governments have had to watch out for.
So hard? You think that they're doing something really good, and so people just don't challenge them, you know, as much, because you wouldn't think somebody that's giving, you know, helping orphanages and children are actually trafficking organs, you know?
Yeah. You know, no, it's like the old Monty Python sketch. Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition, you know?
Yeah,
it's kind of like that. So,
yeah, you don't think the grandma's the spy, you know? It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
So, okay, so at the beginning of this, the government's really cracked down, and there were nefarious characters that were involved with the beginnings of Bitcoin. But the government's actually, U.S. government and different agencies really cracked down on these people, the innocent people that were involved as well. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, I think I know what you're referring to. And, you know, in my book, I should emphasize to your listeners that, you know, if they pick up my book, they can expect, you know, it's not a dry work of economics or finance or a how-to manual for investing in Bitcoin. It's really a nonfiction thriller. It's more like a Michael Lewis book, where it's a deeply reported, character-driven narrative, and we follow this small cast of pioneers who are doing these crazy, impossible things and kind of risking everything to build the early infrastructure of this new economy. And we follow their trials and tribulations, and it's through their eyes that we see all these things unfolding and learn all this stuff. But yeah, so some of the main characters in my book end up suffering at the hands of the government. I don't want to give too much away, but one of them ends up going to federal prison. Actually, two of them end up serving some prison time. One of them ends up renouncing his U.S. citizenship. But one of the guys who was really kind of taken down by the government is this guy named Ross Ulbricht. And he was a 20-something Texan guy. And, you know, he had a graduate degree. He had been a very bright student in science and engineering. And he ended up founding something called Silk Road, which probably a lot of people have heard of by now. Mm-hmm. It was the world's first crypto market, which is a new term. It basically was a new type of underground online black market where most of the transactions were for illegal drugs. And Ross Ulbricht, he did two things for Bitcoin. One was that Bitcoin was the only currency accepted on Silk Road. And the demand was so high that very quickly the commerce happening on Silk Road provided a monetary value for Bitcoin. So Bitcoin launched in January 2009. Silk Road launched in January 2011. And for the 2 years in between, Bitcoin was worth less than a dollar. It was hardly worth anything. Well, within just a couple weeks of Silk Road launching, Bitcoin went above $1 in value, which people at the time, it was a small community, like I said, but they saw that as a really big milestone, that one for one Bitcoin to be to reach parity with the US dollar and then go beyond it. And in fact, with all the price fluctuations Bitcoin has had since then, it has never fallen below $1 in value. But regardless, so as Silk Road kind of grew and grew, it helped to support this idea of Bitcoin having monetary value, because finally there were these goods that people, you know, really wanted, these illicit drugs mostly, that you could only get with Bitcoin, which meant, okay, I guess I need to take some of my US dollars or whatever and acquire Bitcoins with them and then spend the Bitcoins to get the things that I really want and do it in a way that happens, you know, secretly and away out of the government's eye. Well, the second thing that Ross Ulbricht did was that he was a real hardcore but very philosophical and thoughtful kind of crypto libertarian. And he had he sort of became a philosopher drug lord of sorts. He had a lot of you know, motivations for doing what he did, but it wasn't just like a guy from the hood. He had read a lot of economic thinkers and you know, philosophers and economists who kind of helped him justify, you know, what he was doing. And that was something else that he did for Bitcoin, is he did a lot, I think, to associate kind of free market principles and a certain kind of economic ideology with Bitcoin in the early days. He had a forum on the website Silk Road. There was the marketplace where you could buy drugs and stuff, but there was also a discussion forum. And the discussions would, you know, range widely across. Ross Ulbricht even started up a reading club, like a book club, where they would choose a book and then they would all discuss it online. None of them knew each other's names or who they were, but you know, it was a really interesting kind of hothouse environment. But it really helped Bitcoin grow. And then he was taken down in October 2013, as I detail the whole narrative in the book. He was arrested because of some kind of bad operational security on his part and some other things. The government is able to find out who he really was, and they arrested him, and he's currently serving a life sentence in federal prison.
Isn't the government kind of shady in their actions as well with that case?
yeah, so I, you know, again, not to give too much away, I hope people will read it in the book, but yes, actually it turns out that a couple, not just one, but two of the law enforcement officers who were responsible for helping to take down Silk Road, they ended up being corrupt or becoming corrupted themselves. One of them actually stole hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of Bitcoin from one of the guys who'd been a dealer on the site. This was a guy who became a confidential informant for law enforcement, and they took over his account on the Silk Road website so that they could kind of see how the marketplace worked and try to help take it down from the inside. And this law enforcement officer apparently stole a lot of money from the site using this guy's account. And then that ended up making Ross Ulbricht think that he needed to, you know, it looks like he needed to take out a hit on this this guy who he thought, you know, had stolen from him. And it becomes this really, really crazy story where now the two officers, I believe, are both serving time in prison themselves. And certainly that's going to be part of Ross Ulbricht's lawyer is preparing his appeal, or perhaps it's already started. And I believe that is, you know, certainly going to be part of their case. They're going to claim that there were all kinds of improprieties in how their client, you know, was arrested and taken down. But yeah, it becomes, I mean, it truly, I don't even know if I'm doing justice to it. I think I do it much better in the book, but it truly is a crazy story. I mean, you've got this online drug lord using a pseudonym. Nobody knows his real identity. Nobody knows where he lives. Nobody even knows if he's just one guy. The law enforcement, you know, creates this huge multi-agency effort. I mean, you've got the FBI in New York, and then in Maryland, you have this multi-agency task force with the IRS, the Secret Service, the DEA, and all these people simultaneously trying to hunt him down. And then, it turns out that some of the people, the good guys, supposedly are really corrupt themselves. One of them even tried to flee the country.
Well, the good guys, it's always a question mark, what's good and evil? There's such a huge gray area. This would make an amazing, I'm sure they're going to, amazing good movies, good thriller movies. I could see them. I bet you it's already in the works because there's so much material here.
Well, even more than that, I could see it as a drama series. We're in this golden age of TV dramas like Breaking Bad, and I could see it that way, where over the course of a few seasons, you'd follow some of these guys as they build their companies and pursue their ventures and fend off all kinds of challenges and attacks and so on, and then maybe meanwhile, you're following the government trying to, take some of them down or figure out how to deal with all of this brave
Yeah.
new world that we're in.
Who's
But
the good guys and who's the bad guys?
a while back, my book was actually optioned for just that kind of deal to adapt it into this prestige, TV drama series. But that option deal has now lapsed. So if any of your listeners are in Hollywood, you can, get in touch with me or my agency and make me an offer.
Yeah, I think that'd be fascinating. Okay, well, let's get into like the real seriousness of it.
Sure.
I covered cryptocurrencies with Ed Moy, and Ed Moy's the one that tipped me off to talk to you. He used to be the director of the Mint, and he highly recommended me talk to you. But when we were talking about there were certain socialist countries that are really wanting to jump into cryptocurrencies, and their reasons were to be able to track everything, which I could see that being an Orwellian nightmare. So, which is the opposite of the libertarians' move to why they want to create Bitcoin. So, could this ultimately end up being that, where Bitcoin gets taken down and essentially we end up having cryptocurrencies that the governments all control?
Well, I think so Bitcoin's not going to be taken down or taken over in that way, but what we could see in the future, and actually some of the organizations have been quite open about this, what we could see in the future are central bank issued digital currencies. So they would be distinct from these kind of independent cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin in some ways, but they would certainly have some similar features. And some economists these days think it would be great to move to a cashless society because they say, well, what does cash really do for us anyway? It's just it allows people to possibly avoid paying taxes or engage in criminal activity and money laundering and so on. So it'd be great if we could eliminate cash, but in order to do that, we need something else to kind of replace it. And the idea is that maybe you could have these central bank issued digital currencies that would be the thing that replaces the cash. The Bank of England has looked at this. The US Federal Reserve has looked at this. None of them have said they are pursuing it currently. In fact, the Bank of England has officially said it's not pursuing this idea, at least not yet. But I believe the People's Bank of China has looked into it as well. And so we could, potentially see that in the future. And I do think, again, I don't think Bitcoin is going to be taken over by governments in that way. But I do think it's ironic that the invention of Bitcoin, which, as you said, is designed to sort of exist outside the control of governments and big banks and to, allow people to be their own bank and take control of their money and have a form of money that can't just be inflated, away by the Federal Reserve printing more of it or so on. I think it's ironic that the invention of this thing has now kind of, it's kind of broken a sound barrier in a certain way, like a certain psychological sense that now that Bitcoin exists and we're used to thinking about it, now we can start to contemplate these other things, like a central bank issuing its own digital currency. 10 years ago, that was not on anybody's radar. Nobody was thinking about, oh yeah, we could have the Federal Reserve someday, maybe in the next 5 or 10 years or 15 years, issuing its own, digital currency for people. That was just, not in anybody's minds. But it is ironic the way inventions can sometimes get away from their inventors.
And change the whole paradigm of what it was initially intended for. Because I do know that there are some countries that are completely moving to cashless and for
I
that
think one of the
purpose.
Nordic countries is doing
Yeah,
that,
I think
right?
it's
Yes, Sweden or
Sweden.
something.
Yeah, I think it was Sweden. And for that, they're they're socialists, and for that purpose of being able to track everything. Of course, right. they're not telling their citizens that, but, you know, our libertarian-minded folks here in the United States would probably melt. You know, I mean, it would be, this would not be accepted very well here.
Right. I mean, the term that gets used for this, proposed theoretical central bank issued digital currency in the U.S. is Fed coin. That's what they call it. And that's, some people use it as a derisive kind of term, but other people just use it as, you know, a handy moniker. And yeah, it's, you know, that's one of the unfortunate things, because I find Bitcoin fascinating. I think on balance, it's a good thing for the world. You know, certainly that was one of the things that drew me to write a whole book about it. When I first encountered it, I just thought it was an idea whose time had come. I think it makes a lot of sense in this globalized world we're living in to have a kind of universal currency that, you know, works as well in New York as it does in New Delhi in India, right? And it exists on this network independent of any government or bank.
I think the problem there's great is that, things with it. Also, yeah. Not to cut you off, but no, people sure. in rural areas now have the ability, with just having a smartphone or whatever, can do business where they Absolutely. can't get bank accounts. So it's actually Absolutely. Creating an economy for rural areas where there wasn't one. It's lifting people out of poverty. Yeah. There's a lot of good parts.
That. Yes. Yeah, because they're you know, in the U.S., most of us are pretty lucky. We have our bank accounts and our credit reports and, you know, all these ways that we can sort of prove that we are who we say we are, and we deserve to get a mortgage, and we deserve, you know, to you know, when I swipe a credit card, you know, the credit card company trusts that I'm going to pay that money back and so on. But there are 2 billion adults in the world today, all over the world, 2 billion adults who don't have a bank account at all. And then there are others who they're what's known as the unbanked. And then there are others who are known as underbanked, because while they might have access to some financial services, they don't really have full access to financial services. And there's some of these people exist even in the United States, and they are preyed upon by, you know, payday lenders and loan sharks and others. And, you know, even in parts of the world where they might not be preyed upon by payday lenders, what it does is it simply means that they can't participate in the global economy.
Do you have to have a bank to participate?
Right. Well, that's right? Exactly right. So look at Africa. Africa actually has huge adoption of mobile phones, including even smartphones. They did not, like in the United States, we had the intermediate step of installing this nationwide network of landlines, right, with these big telephone poles and wires stretching coast to coast. But in Africa, they didn't need to invest in that. They just simply leapfrogged it and went straight to mobile phones. And so a lot of people, and I talk about this in the book, a lot of people are thinking this could happen in Africa with digital currency, that, you know, if they can have this means of participating in the global economy, why would they need to set up a continent-wide, you know, system of traditional banks with a branch on every corner?
Exactly, because your bank would be in the cloud, if you will. I hate that term, but that's how people think of it. Okay, so Ethereum and Bitcoin have been skyrocketing in values. I mean, that's the reality. Yep. From, you know, what you're saying, Bitcoin is over $3,000 right now, and it was started off, and it was a big milestone just when it got over a dollar. Right. Ethereum is doing the same thing. It's skyrocketing. Do you see this as accelerating the decline of the dollar?
You know, it's tough to say. It's always risky to put yourself in the position of Nostradamus, right, and make predictions. But I don't think Bitcoin and Ethereum and things like that are going to replace the U.S. dollar anytime soon. But then again, you know, Bitcoin didn't even exist 10 years ago, and now the total market for cryptocurrencies is over $120 billion. So from zero to $120 billion is pretty crazy in less than a decade. So who knows what the next decade might bring. But I do think it is it's giving people more options, right? Rather than them having to use the dollar. And you know, I mean, I'm pretty young. I just turned 31 a couple of months ago. And so most of my adult life, I've grown up in an era of chronically low interest rates. And that means that when I have money in my savings account at the bank, I'm just losing value year by year if I let it sit there in the bank, because the interest rates are so low, they are below the rate of inflation. And that means that, you know, if I have $5,000 in the bank, it's actually can buy, it's still $5,000 next year, but it can't purchase as much as it used to. Well, I do think that people have been very excited to hold a form of money, this kind of digital commodity money, that actually has been gaining in value historically. Now, month to month, it might gain or it might drop in value. Or even in 2015 and parts of 2016, the price of Bitcoin was kind of in the doldrums. And some people, you know, were selling it at a loss. But historically, if you look at the chart over time, it has been just a massive increase in value. Now, what do hedge funds always tell their clients? They say past performance is no guarantee of future results, right? So we can't guarantee anything about the future value of Bitcoin or Ethereum or any of these other digital currencies that have been inspired by Bitcoin and have arisen in the years since. But there are a lot of people who have staked a lot on them, and it looks very promising, I think.
Well, the dollar's in decline, right? Because they kept printing it and printing and printing to the point where there's so many dollars, the value of a single dollar is very low. Inflation has gone, you know, through the roof since 1913 when they created the Federal Reserve.
Right.
So, you know, you get other currencies that skyrocket and the dollar's already in decline. I mean, you know, you wonder if this could be a practical replacement for the dollar or something like this, because there needs to be a dollar reset. I mean, you're everywhere, a dollar reset. You know, I wonder how this could maybe help create a smooth transition. I mean, I don't know if there's a possibility of a smooth transition, if there is going to be a big bumpy ride, or if there is some magical player that can create a dollar reset and a smooth transition. Wouldn't that be nice?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, some people are using Bitcoin as a transactional currency, but many are using it as a form of digital gold, as a store of value that they think will hold its value or increase its value over time. And some people are holding it that way as a hedge against these economic shocks in the traditional financial markets and in the traditional economy, you know, that affect currencies like the dollar and the pound. Look at what happened to the pound after Brexit, right? The value declined sharply and still has not fully recovered to its former level. So, you know, and the value of the dollar, although you were saying, you know, in the last 100 years, it's declined sharply, I think it hasn't declined as sharply as it would have if not for the fact that it has been the world's reserve currency and people have not really had other options, right? So when you talk about accelerating the decline of the dollar, I might not phrase it exactly like that, but I see what you mean. And yeah, in terms of the store of value aspect for Bitcoin, for instance, the, you know, we didn't dig into this too much, but one of the breakthrough aspects of Bitcoin was that Satoshi Nakamoto found a way, he invented a way for the first time to have a scarce digital asset. Now, what does that mean? That means that, you know, when I send you an iPhone photo, I keep a copy on my phone and you get a copy on your phone. If I email you a Word document, we both have copies of it. So the problem with attempts to create electronic cash before Bitcoin were essentially, how do I know that this money isn't just going to be spent an infinite number of times? You know, if I send electronic currency to somebody, why should they trust that it has any value when I could be double or triple or quadruple spending it? Well, the way a company like PayPal solves that is by being the man in the middle who has the accounts and says, okay, this person sent money to this other person, so I'm going to take money from this one person's account and put it in the other person's account. You know, well, that's great, but if you don't want to trust a central company, how do you do it? Satoshi Nakamoto invented a way to do decentralized digital cash where you wouldn't have to trust a man in the middle, but it would still have a limited supply. And so that's the thing. You mentioned with the dollar, the Federal Reserve can kind of print more whenever it wants. Not so with Bitcoin. There's no Federal Reserve. There's no central mint that can just decide to print more. New Bitcoins right now are being created by these stakeholders in the Bitcoin economy known as miners. They're responsible for using their computer processing power to verify and record transactions on the network. And as a reward for maintaining the network in this way, they get new Bitcoins at a predetermined rate. So there is some inflation in the supply of Bitcoins right now, but everybody knows what it's going to be in advance. There's no mystery to it. And it's declining over time. Every 4 years, the number of new Bitcoins being created gets cut in half. So ultimately, it's dwindling away to a point where the total number of Bitcoins that will ever exist in the world is is 21 million Bitcoins.
And now, the Bitcoins are just fractionalized, right? So that you can have like 1/16 of a Bitcoin.
Absolutely.
You can trade.
Even more than that, yes, each Bitcoin is divisible down to 8 decimal places. So, you know, if someday one Bitcoin is worth $50,000, you and I won't be talking about, oh, I spent a Bitcoin anymore. It'll be like you spent 1/1000th or 1/1000000th of a Bitcoin or something like that.
And that'll probably have its own names.
Right, like a millibitcoin, I think, is 1/1000th of a Bitcoin. And then the smallest value, the down to 8 decimal places, that's known as one Satoshi. Actually, it's kind of a cute name, named for the creator, mm-hmm. of course. But the last point I just wanted to make was that someone actually pointed out to me, this is not my own realization, so I can't take credit for it, but it's pretty fascinating to think about. There are not even enough Bitcoins in the world for every millionaire in the United States to have just one. Okay, so what that means is if this continues to be seen as a great store of value and its value continues to go up over time and people want to hold it as a hedge against shocks in the regular economy, or they want to hold it as a safe haven asset. I mean, look at the scandal of the Panama Papers, all this money being held offshore. Mm-hmm. If people start to move some of that kind of money and wealth into this digital asset, you can imagine what might happen to its value and the demand for it. But yet there are not even enough of them for every millionaire just in the United States, not even in the world, to just have one for themselves.
Well, question for you, as this thing grows, isn't there an issue with the computing power?
Well, you know, that's not my exact area of expertise, but what do you mean specifically?
Well, because every computer needs to track every ledger. And my understanding is that Ethereum actually solves some of those issues. And so long-term Ethereum might actually be a better, sounder currency, because Bitcoin, it may have some issues with scalability.
Well, actually, so there's just one ledger with Bitcoin, and it's that every computer running the Bitcoin software maintains an identical copy of that ledger.
That's
on its
what
system.
I mean.
And it's reconciled in real time. Yeah. Well, the thing is, you can participate in the Bitcoin economy without having to run that Bitcoin software. Like, I don't have a copy of the Bitcoin ledger recording all the transactions on my computer, but I could still hold Bitcoins if I wanted to and send them to you. There is a huge amount of processing power now being devoted to the Bitcoin network, to maintaining it. And, you know, I'm not sure where that might go over time, but we do know that, you know, computers are becoming more powerful over time and so on. And, yeah, it's an interesting question. In terms of, you know, some of the scalability, there actually, for the last couple of years, there was this sort of civil war raging in the Bitcoin community, because everyone seemed to be, or most everyone seemed to be in agreement that Bitcoin's software needed to be upgraded in some way in order to help it continue to grow and reach an even larger, you know, global user base. But there were competing proposals, and each one had its partisans, and there was a lot of debate and sort of sniping at each other over which proposal was better. Well, one of those proposals was pretty much finally agreed upon and is going to be enacted. And actually, that's why in the last just week or so, the value of Bitcoin has skyrocketed. It, you know, it's gone up from like $2,700 to $3,400 or so. And it had fallen in the past few weeks as low as $1,800, because there was a lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt surrounding the issue of, you know, is Bitcoin going to fall off a cliff? Are people going to be able to solve these scalability issues? And it looks like, you know, at least for the time being, a solution has been found. And so a lot of confidence has surged back into the Bitcoin community.
Oh, interesting. So that's something that people can look into. Well, where can people learn more about you and get a copy of your book? Because it sounds absolutely fascinating.
Oh, sure. Thanks. Yeah. It's so the book is available at Barnes & Noble and bookstores around the country. If you like to support your local independent bookstore and they don't have it in stock, they would be more than happy to order it for you. But you can certainly find it on Amazon.com. You can get it as a hardcover book right now or as a Kindle ebook. Or if you like other ebook formats, you can find it in the Google Play Store or on Apple's iBooks and I think a couple of other formats. But yeah, I mean, go on Amazon. If you're a Prime member, you get it with free 2-day shipping. And that's
what's
what I've been telling
a
lot of my friends.
What's
it's how Money Got Free, Bitcoin and the Fight for the Future of Finance. How Money Got Free. And as I said, it's really the definitive account of the origin and rise of Bitcoin and its implications for the world, socially, politically, economically, and technologically. But it's through this cast of colorful, eccentric, brilliant characters that we learn all about it.
Well, it's so interesting because it takes out the banks.
Yeah,
and I find that is very interesting, right?
That is interesting, although I will say some banks have certainly seem to be in the process of kind of putting their own stamp on blockchain technology or co-opting
it.
But as for where you can learn more about me, I do have a website, although it hasn't been updated in a long time, and it's really something I need to upgrade or replace. But I'm very active on Twitter. You can find me there at Brian Eha. My last name is spelled E-H-A. For the purposes of my professional byline or my book cover, I go by Brian Patrick Eha, but my handle on Twitter is Brian Eha because I've been there so long that it was from back in the days where Twitter counted the characters in your handle against you if against the 140
yep.
character limit if somebody was trying to tweet at you. So I made a shorter version. And then my website is brianpatrickeha.com.
Oh, excellent. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining. This was very interesting.
Oh, thank you, Sarah. Yeah, I hope I was able to give you the answers you were looking for.
Yeah, this was great. Have a wonderful day.
Oh, you too.